the Bible, which has taken us weeks to do because it's kind of a big book. It's like, well, the Bible, the word Bible means library, and it's got 66 books in it. Or if you're a Catholic, there's even more than that. But so we have been just following the storyline, and I think we've got up to somewhere just past Solomon, and we're getting ready to head towards the New Testament. But I wanted to take today to just step back to look at, again, the big picture. The reason we're doing this is it's one thing to hear little stories here and there from the Bible, but when we hear the whole story, and it takes a long time to do it, it gives us a sort of a broader picture of what God's doing. What we find when we hear these stories is there's kind of repeating themes that are happening over and over and over again. Or there's lessons that God wants to teach us. My sermon today is titled, How Does God Work in Our Lives? And maybe even the question for some people would even be, does God work in our lives? I mean, do you actually believe that God works? Well, if you're thinking about our life and how God interacts, I mean, there's the present that we're living in right now. There's a past that, well, it's the past. We've already been there and done that. There's not much we can do about it. So one of the things I think we really are interested in is what's going to happen in our lives in the future. If God has a plan for our life, it would be good to see what direction we're going or whatever. And so we take a look at, we want to find out the future. We want to see what is it that God's doing. In the present, I mean, the present is already gone, what I just said. I mean, it's always becomes the past as we walk along. Probably the biggest significant thing we have is choices that are put before us. And we have the consequences and things that come from the choices that we have. And so we usually don't worry about what has happened. We might feel guilty or ashamed of what has happened, but that's gone. So what can we do to influence the future? I mean, there's a lot of us that think that, well, like, I don't know about you. I was raised with a lot of superstitions. Knock on wood, throw some salt over your shoulder, cross your fingers, black cats, all those kinds of things. I remember two things. One was my mother would freak when I busted a mirror. It was like 7 years bad luck. The other one she said is you can't walk under a ladder. And I remember one day as a little kid, I walked under the ladder. My dad was up working on something and he yelled at me. And I said, what is this, superstitious that I walked under the ladder? He goes, it would be bad luck for you if I dropped a tool on your head. Don't walk under the ladder. So he had a little different approach to it. So, so maybe we can influence the future. And I want to see what's next. Okay, I'm going to wait a second then. We can influence the future, but what part does God have in our future? I mean, does he really care about us? Is he really involved in our life? I found this cartoon, and this is sarcasm. I don't believe this is really what happens, but in this cartoon, this is God at the master control panel. See, and I mean, things like, yes, you can eat this, no, you can't eat this, and now you will die. When he gives you the ice age, the jelly age, I haven't heard of that one before. Armageddon, at least he's got that covered up. Snakes, light, allow, deny. He's got the rain, off, drizzle, light rain, shower, downpour, sleet, monsoon, typhoon, fire, frogs, men, and clowns, I don't know. For communicating with humans, intercom, deep voice, helium voice, he crossed that one out, thunder, lightning, and then he smites us. I didn't actually know God got people pregnant. Well, he did marry, but other than that, AIDS, extinction. So this was one cartoonist's view of God controlling people's lives. And so, I mean, I think there's two approaches you could take to this. It's either that you don't believe in this at all, or you don't believe God works at all. Superstition is really still alive and well. I don't know if you have seen that. If any of you ever watch some of the sports, some of those athletes are really superstitious. I mean, I found this little thing, black cat walking across there. But I had Googled sports and superstition. This one came up. Now, why is this superstitious? Well, let me tell you from my own experience. I played football for that mighty powerhouse, Ida, Michigan. And when we were playing football, one of the things we decided to do, which now is really gross, but is we decided not to change our socks for the whole season. And yeah, and we wore two pair of socks, and you were constantly matching them up so they covered the holes of the other sock, you know, so you had a whole sock. But I mean, it was our superstition. I mean, Sparky Anderson, when he was the coach of the Tigers, he came out to the mound, whichever side he came from. When he hit the baseline, he'd step over it. That was his superstition. I mean, all these guys have different things that that they just sort of believe in. They're good luck charms. And again, many of us have been raised with all this crazy kind of stuff. It's superstition. It is something that you may blow it off. You may say, well, you know, this isn't real. But then again, it seems to have survived generation after generation. And it seems to have been handed down. And you wonder sometimes. There is a, I'm way ahead of this. I'm sorry about this. I was busy with baptisms yesterday. I didn't get through this well enough. But there's a basis for superstition, believe it or not. There is an old theory of how the world works, and it's called the continuity theory. And what it says is everything affects everything. And so if something happens in heaven, it affects earth. If something happens with people, it affects the world, it affects heaven. They're all connected together and interconnected. And that's where humans are connected to nature. And as they walk in, there's all this mysterious connection going on. And sort of the key element in all that is fate. Something happens, you go, that was just fate. I knew that was going to happen. I knew that it was fate that I was going to get in this car wreck or whatever. Fate is the major driving function that gives you the ability to predict things that come up in the future. It's the basis of belief of the horoscope, the astrology stuff. See, in astrology, it believes that when you were born, the way that where the planets were, where the moon was, all of that affects your life and will affect your life for the rest of your life. That's this continuity theory. It says, and if you find people who are true believers in the horoscope, and they follow it all the time. And what is actually a little scary is, is that sometimes it actually works. The things that they say, I mean, sometimes they're so general that it would fit anyone, but sometimes there really seems to be a power behind it. Back in ancient days, now remember we started with Garden of Eden, and we sort of quickly moved over to Abraham and what they call the patriarchs, the oldest members of the Jewish tradition. Well, back in that time, which would have been 4,000 years ago, 2000 BC, this was the driving force for everything. I mean, it was a matter of that fate was just going to happen. What's going to happen is going to happen. the Babylonians had a book of omens. And if you were I don't know what you call them, wizard or whatever, in the courts in Babylon, you had to know the book of omens. Problem was, there were 70,000 of them, and it was 7 volumes long. And some of them contradicted others. But on the other hand, I mean, so for instance, the king is walking out on a Tuesday, and it's raining, and he gets hit by lightning. So they write that down in the book, and from then on, a king never walks out on Tuesday if it's raining, because they know he's going to get hit by lightning. I mean, it's that kind of thing, superstition, as we call it. And so you have this Babylon, I mean, from the omens of Babylon, astrology in ancient Mesopotamia. This is well documented. I mean, you can find that kind of thing happening. Well, at times then we feel like, well, if there's fate, then we're trapped. I mean, it's like, okay, there's fate, so I got to go this way. And in fact, the people who are following the horoscopes and astrology and that, they look at it and they go, oh crap, it's going to be a bad day. I think I'll stay home from work. I mean, that's the best they can do. They can't change what's going to happen. Fate is driving the driving force in their life. The good news that we have is that we don't live under that kind of bondage. We don't have the world's bondage to all of this fate and all of this superstition and that kind of thing, because we have an effect on what we can do in our lives. We have a power that's greater than all of this stuff put together. So if you tell me that's real, I'm going to say, yeah, it probably is. But it's not real stuff from God, because God has a whole different way of us living our lives. And he has given us a tool to be able to change our lives. And he calls that tool prayer. But it isn't just a now I lay me down to sleep kind of prayer. It is a prayer in which we can actually talk to, communicate with a living God. And what's scary is he can communicate with us. And he's wanting to do it, and he's trying to do it all of the time. He's out there. I mean, in Isaiah, Isaiah says, God's going, here I am, here I am. He's trying to get our attention. He is sometimes screaming in our face as we're walking down a road of fate, down a road of maybe even bad choices and destruction. And he's saying, I want you to communicate with me. I have this plan for your life. And if I say it's going to happen in your life, it's going to happen in your life. But it's going to be a good thing. And he says, and he can change the fate of the world. He can change things if we, individually or corporately, come to him in prayer. You can change God's mind. I don't know if I was going to look it up, but I decided not to read it, but there's a story in Genesis in which Abraham is arguing with God. God wants to destroy Sodom. And Abraham says, if there's 50 good men there, would you not destroy it? And he actually changes God's mind. And God goes, well, but he can't find 50 good men in Sodom. So he takes it to 20 and 10 and I mean, he keeps lowering the number and apologizing to God and saying, you know, I know you're going to get me for this, but he actually can change God's mind. And he can do, through prayer changes things. I don't completely understand all the dynamics of it, but I know and I have seen it happen over and over and over again. So we want to go before God. God is immutable. He never changes. That doesn't mean he doesn't change his mind. He himself, who he is, what he is, all of goodness, all of love, is always the same, but he's passable is the word. He can change his emotions. He can change the direction of things by us coming to him. Sometimes we come to him and say, oh God, don't let this person die. Or sometimes we can come to him and say, God, I need your help in such and such. And everything's going this way, he can turn things and change what's happening. It's an important thing in our lives that we know that we have a living God who we can interact. We have a relationship. We're just not robots that are walking out. But it's a matter of him being able to be our friend, but also be the one who watches over us. I once said it's amazing. If you think about God, there's billions of people in the world. The amount of intelligence that it takes for billions of people, for God to make things work, turn out for the good for billions of people. I mean, the intelligence is amazing. Now let's throw one more thing in, which is the majority of these people aren't listening to God and going to do what they want to do. And he still can bring things into his plan for his good. That takes even more of an intelligence. So one of the misunderstandings we have about how God works in our life is that we're stuck in fate. And that's just simply not true. Another misunderstanding that's common, and this is the one I run into the most. If you think I'm talking about you, you're probably right, but there's a lot of you in this category. And that's that if we're good, God owes us something. So if we're good, then he's got to do this. And of course, when we're bad, he's going to smuck us. But when we're good, then he owes us. You know, it's like, and so it's all about us being bad and good. As a child, we're taught this. We get this particular thing hit at us when we're just the littlest of little. Santa's making his list to see who's been naughty or nice. So, you know, have you been naughty? Then you shouldn't, well, you should be at church, I guess. Or have you been nice? Then you could stay, you know. I mean, it's the sort of the lie that comes into our life all the time. I mean, it's important to do good. I'm not saying that. But it's not a matter of that it's all about following rules. It's all about doing good, all about being good. It has more to do with being loving than to being good. There's the obvious that good and bad choices affect our life and our future. And God did say in a covenant that we heard about earlier, if you were in the sermon series, that if you do this, I will do that. Those were covenants that we made with God. And he does honor that kind of thing. But the thing is, he goes beyond it. If we don't do what we're supposed to do, often God still does what he is agreed to do, even though we haven't been obedient. When he gives us things that we don't deserve, it's called grace. When he holds back punishment that we do deserve, it's called mercy. And God is a God of grace and a God of mercy. Just like the parent, he may have his limits at times and pull us up short, but that's where he's at. Because his covenant can be stated like this: I will be your God, and you will be my people, and I will dwell with you. I'm going to live with you every day. We used to tell our kids, you can't get away with anything. God's watching. And my oldest daughter, as a teenager, she snuck out and got caught right away. And actually by friends, not even us. And so from that point on, she believed it. And but, I mean, God wants what is best for us. I mean, God intends that what we do with him is relational. A relationship with God is the best relationship you can have, as this sign says. He wants us to please and love him, not just do something to get something out of it. It's not about that kind of thing. I mean, people, you can tell when people are doing something, they're sort of kissing up to you to get something out of you. That's not a very good relationship. You don't have great feelings. God doesn't either. He doesn't like that kind of thing. So Like I said, this is the most frequently misunderstanding of God and that I encounter as a pastor. And so this actually is the answer to the question, why, if there is a God, why do bad things happen? Why do evil things happen? We were in Alpha class Friday night, and we found out that there was evil. And if you add one letter to it, there's devil. And we believe in both. It was something that everyone who got baptized yesterday denounced, was the devil. He's not a little pitchfork guy, as I told folks yesterday. He is real evil. Pull out your newspaper, open up the news. What's his name? Castro got 1,000 years in prison for what he did to those three girls in Cleveland. You know, 1,000 years. I mean, he's got God to face on that. And I don't want to be fire and brimstone, but it's a matter of that God really wants us just to love him. There's a book in the Bible that is written to contradict the idea of that if you do everything right, everything will go well. God decided to write a whole book of the Bible, and that book is called Job. And let me see if I can read from Job. If you can see that. It says, in the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. It's not Job, it's Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among the people of the East. His sons used to hold feasts in their home on their birthdays, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of fasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice burnt offerings for each of them, thinking perhaps my children may have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. This was Job's regular custom. This is a guy who was just a good guy. He was one you could kind of be proud of. He was the true Boy Scout. He was the one who was going to do what's right. Okay, so one day the angels come to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came with them. Why would Satan come with the angels? Because Satan was an angel. He was the highest archangel, the most beautiful. He was called the angel of light until he realized that he was so wonderful. And he had such pride that he fell. That's the pride is what took him out. The Lord said to Satan, where have you come from? Satan answered the Lord, from roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. Does Job fear God for nothing? Satan replied. Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But now stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. Moses is saying, yeah, anybody can be good when everything's going well for him. That's what Satan's saying. So The Lord said to Satan, very well then, everything he has is in your power, but on the man himself do not lay a finger. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. The story's telling us that there is a spiritual warfare going on, a dynamics that's going on in heaven that is outside of our behaviors, our performance, our all those kinds of things. There is true evil in the world. As St. Paul says, we live in the present evil age. And he's calling us to recognize that we're in a battle. And when you're in a battle, I mean, it is really dangerous. It's tough. If you were at war, you'd have two choices. And especially if somebody declares war on you, you don't have a choice to say, no, thanks. The terrorists attack us. We don't have a chance to say, I don't think we want to play in this war. You either have two choices. One is you fight, and you find out who your enemy is. You get the weapons that you need, that kind of thing. Or the other is you give up, and you go into a concentration camp, and that's where you spend the war. It's sort of the same kind of thing of what we have. So let's continue on with our story. So one day when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabaeans attacked and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep, the servants, and I'm the only one who's escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, the Chaldeans formed three raiding parties and swept down on your camels and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I'm the only one who escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, yet another messenger, this is a bad day, I'll tell you, came and said, your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on them, and they are dead, and I'm the only one who escaped to tell you. So Job heard all of this, and he was stunned. And first thing he did, he was devastated. And first thing he did is to say, Lord, what's going on? Didn't I do everything you told me to do? And all this is happening to me. What's going on? And then to make things worse, Job's wife comes to him and starts saying, you know what? You ought to curse God and die. You've obviously done something wrong. It's got to be your fault. And then on top of it, and you can read this whole story of Job, but on top of it, Job has three friends who come, and they're really supportive of him, as you can see in this picture. Whose fault is it? Well, all the friends say, Job, obviously you did something wrong. Well, at this point, God shows up and starts speaking. He speaks to Job, and he's arguing with Job, or Job is actually arguing with him. It's really one-sided. And then he also caught, well, he's arguing with Job, and Job realizes, I really am no one to question God. And he says, again, and this is at now in chapter 42, then Job replied to the Lord, I know that you can do all things. No purpose of yours can be thwarted. You asked, who is this that obscures my plan without knowledge? Why are you questioning me, is what God says. Surely I hope I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You got to realize what God has said to Job is, I created the world. Where were you when I did that? Are you now God? You're telling me all the things that I should be doing? Continue on. You said, listen now, and I will speak, and I will question you, and you shall answer me. My ears have heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. God made Job's friends repent, and then Job's last half of his life was even more fruitful than the first half. What do we learn from this? Number one, Satan is the accuser and attacker behind what is evil in our lives. And he even helps us in making stupid decisions. Number two, we're not in a place to question God and his plans for us. Question three, we're not in a place to judge each other. Oh, well, this is your own fault that you got into this, even though it probably was. And finally, God only wants what is good for us. That's what he really cares about. Now, that's the book of Job. I want to briefly hit one other book in a couple minutes, and that's the book of Ecclesiastes. It's written by Solomon, the great wise man of the Bible. But I had heard a professor, a seminary professor, once say that when you're reading Job and Ecclesiastes, you want to do a reverse interpretation. You want to believe the opposite of what it says in most of the places there. What I'm saying is, in Job, you're getting all this vast wisdom from his three friends. And then if you read that and you start taking that part of the Bible and say, this is what we should be doing, God's going, oy vey, what are you doing? You know. And so Job, most of it, until God starts speaking, is really we need to reverse the interpretation. Ecclesiastes is the same way. In that book, Solomon is writing in a very sarcastic way. Solomon is, and I think when Tim was preaching one Sunday, he was talking about just all of the opulence, all of the things that Solomon had, food, and he had 1,000 wives, and he had all kinds of herds, and he ruled over a vast empire. He had everything he could possibly want. And from that, he found that really didn't make him happy. So in Ecclesiastes, he says, this is the book he wrote, a wisdom book, the words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What do people gain from all their labor at which they toil under the sun? Other translations use this wonderful word vanity. It means that, gee, it seems like everything we do, I've got everything in the world and I'm not happy. Well, because those things are not going to bring happiness in our lives. I've got a short video that I would like to show. Some of you have seen this already, so forgive me for that, but I think you could still stand to see it again. And the question that this video asks is, very simply, are we asking the wrong question of life? Tell me what you think of this. I don't think we need the lights off, but...
So there might be a question that you're asking that's making you unhappy. You might be asking it when you're clashing with your significant other. You might be asking it when your boss weighs in on your latest project. You might be asking it in the gap between what you imagined your kids would be like and what they're actually like. This question could be phrased a couple of different ways, but I'll say it this way. Why aren't you giving me better stuff? Why aren't you giving me my ideal romantic experience? Why aren't you giving me approval and promotion? Why aren't you making me look good, or at least making my life easier? We also do this to inanimate objects. Why aren't you working? Why aren't you giving me money? Why aren't you making me a winner? Most importantly, we ask this question of life. We spend a lot of time stressing about this, having this internal dialogue of worry where we're asking, why aren't things going better? How can I make things go better? Why don't I have the reputation I want with the people around me? Why don't I have the skills and talents I want? Why aren't I catching the breaks that would really put me where I want to be? A lot of people turn this question toward the concept of God. People point to this as a reason to say there's probably no such thing as God. If God is so hip, why isn't he giving us all better stuff? Like less suffering, more happiness, more success, more winning the lottery. Where are you, God? Why are you giving me these strange, confusing, often very painful, or at least annoying, life events? If you love me, God, why aren't you giving me better stuff? It's got to be up there with the most asked questions of all time, if not explicitly and verbally, then implicitly, internally. But there's a major assumption here, one that's rarely examined, which is, what really is better stuff? For example, a lot of people think that one of the coolest things that could ever happen would be to suddenly have a lot of free money. But as some of you have probably already heard, when people study this, winning a huge pile of money doesn't make you happier. Winning a smaller amount of money in a BMW doesn't make you happier. And actually, winning big can mess up your ability to enjoy the regular little events in your life. A lot of people think that it would be really cool to be the best at something, to be an extraordinary talent. But a body of studies find that Olympic athletes, the best of the best, often struggle with pretty serious depression after the Olympics are over. But why? Why doesn't getting the things we want make us happy? Isn't the lack of them the reason we were unhappy in the first place? Or is there something else going on here? Well, here's a different theory. So assuming he isn't living at a level of poverty where he really needs money for a decent life, it might be that what's driving this guy to want to win the lottery in the first place is an internal state of being dissatisfied with your current situation, longing for more of the things you don't have, and looking to that for happiness. That's the mode he's been running. So when he actually does win, all this cash comes spilling in. It gets into and changes his bank account. It gets into and changes his living situation. It gets into and changes the number of boats he owns. But it can't get into and change him. After the initial surge wears off, the program will continue to run. Now I'm dissatisfied with my surroundings again. Yeah, I have a boat, but it breaks down sometimes and is not nearly as cool as the boat these guys at the end of the dock have. If only I could just get an extra pile of cash and get that boat, then I'd really be set and I wouldn't have to worry and I could live the kind of life. And well, yeah, in a relationship you can work on compromising and trying to meet each other's needs. But the problem is that here, on a certain level, both parties are operating through the belief that love equals somebody giving me what I want or matching up with my romantic expectations. And no matter how much that's placated and catered to by the other partner, it's never going to turn into a real, sustainable, not self-centered desire to be a good partner for someone, aka love. The partner or the relationship isn't the problem. That is the problem. So when we're throwing up that question, the stuff we're agonizing about not getting actually isn't good for us at all. The real problem to be remedied in any of these situations is not what's happening in the situation, it's our attitude toward the situation. It's our attitude towards money, it's our attitude towards relationships, it's our attitude towards success. So if the cap on our happiness is our internal world, what really is better stuff? Not stuff that improves our situation, stuff that improves us. So if you're going to ask God, why aren't you giving me better stuff? That's fine, man. I know. Life can be really frustrating. But just consider that if we've been able to figure this out about what's good for us over the course of this 6-minute video, an omniscient, omnipresent God would probably already be on top of this and be choosing what he gives when from this perspective. Don't you think? I'm going to suggest that you swap your question. Instead of asking of situations, of events, of people, why aren't you giving me better stuff? Ask, how is this helping me grow? How is this freeing me from the internal attitudes and beliefs that got me unhappy in the first place? Yeah, I didn't win, but losing has cooled my ego off with some humility and really has led me to be more accepting and forgiving towards flaws in myself and in others in a way that I wasn't before. Not being able to just jump out of my situation, while it's been a grind at times, has gotten me to better appreciate the things I do have, and that ability to work with what I have has been so helpful since I started a family. Not getting everything I want has forced me to take a look at myself and the dysfunction I bring to the relationship like I never have before. It's actually improving the way I relate to everyone I interact with. Switching that question might be the easiest way in the world to shed a bunch of unhappiness, discontent, and anxiety. Just try it. Watch the way it transforms situations, perspectives, experiences, and if you keep it up for a while, you might be able to see, on a bigger scale, just where and when you are getting
better stuff. I cut it off at the end. You notice this isn't a particularly religious video. Losing my voice from yesterday. But it really does hit the questions of what is it that really is going to make us happy. It isn't going to be more stuff, as he said. We find that the same lesson was learned by Solomon. True happiness is only found in loving God, because for him, he has a plan for our life that really is going to make us grow. And he says, God has a plan for your life. The enemy has a plan for your life. Actually, this is not in the Bible, but be ready for both. Just be wise enough to know which one is battle and which one to embrace. The scripture is, for I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future. That's what God is calling us to. He wants each and every one of us to have a hope and a future.